negative stereotyping of the Irish by the English was first recorded in the 12th century when Gerald of Wales wrote of a people who lived like beasts, their lands barren because they were lazy. He was laying the groundwork for King Henry II's invasion of Ireland, a hearts and minds exercise to convince the king's subjects that invasion was necessary and that Henry had a legitimate claim. It was a tactic that would be deployed in Ireland for centuries. I'm Christine Leach, and in this series of Ireland Portrayed, I'm exploring how ideas of Ireland and Irish identity have been visually represented over 300 years. Across this series, I want to excavate identity in just some of our iconic historical and political artworks and through specific events. To catch a glimpse of how art has told our story, how others would like to see us, and how we see ourselves. In today's episode, we'll explore how and why in art and illustration the portrayal of the Irish as subhuman other persisted. How this ingrained image influenced the political response during the horror of the 19th century's Great Famine and Land Wars, and the dogged resistance to a new story of the Irish emerging. To do that, we must first go a little further back and begin outside arguably one of the most important buildings in Ireland. From 1204 until the keys were handed to Michael Collins in 1922, Dublin Castle was the seat of English and later British rule here. It was the administrative centre and home to the representative of England's monarch in Ireland.
By 1581, that monarch is the Tudor Queen, Elizabeth I. And in that year, a set of very expensive illustrations is published to celebrate her representative Sir Henry Sidney and his victories over a barbarous and rebellious Irish. I'm here with writer and art historian Fintan Cullen. Fintan, this gate was the backdrop to a great show of English military power, and that scene was actually depicted in a woodcut. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, the woodcut is a series of about 10 or 12 produced by an Englishman. Derek, in the late-ish part of the Elizabethan period, produced a poem called The Image of Ireland, which is ostensibly a kind of bit of propaganda to show how the Irish are a bunch of dirty and not very attractive people, bad soldiers, hideous manners, while English and particularly Elizabethan civilization under the then Viceroy, Sir Henry Sidney, would bring civilization. I think it's number 6, shows Henry Sidney leaving the castle in its early medieval state.
But even though the castle has changed, we can still situate ourselves because we can see in the woodcut Christchurch Cathedral.
We can, in the medieval city, which if these 18th century buildings which surround us weren't there, because the medieval cities were quite low-lying. So yes, this is a view of Dublin. So we're basically standing on what would have been the original ramparts of the castle.
John Derrick's The Image of Ireland with the Discovery of Woodcairn was art with political intent. It told a story of a military campaign, but more importantly, these images gave the audience justification for Elizabethan conquest.
Henry Sidney is the Queen's man, so to speak, in Ireland. And he is shown in this woodcut, sitting on his horse, leaving the castle, surrounded by his army, men holding spears and a man blowing a trumpet. And he's about to go out on a kind of tour of Ireland, where he will then see some of the things which the other woodcuts show, such as the Irish and their barbarity.
Across a series of 12 woodcuts and texts, Derek depicts the wild, barbaric Gaelic rebels and their eventual subjugation by voluntary submission or Sidney's sword.
Tell me a little bit about the themes in Derek's prints.
I mean, basically what you're getting here is we're talking about 200 or 300 years after the Anglo-Norman invasion, and you have an Elizabethan Tudor monarchy, now the third or fourth Tudor monarch, trying to consolidate and maintain absolute order in this quite difficult land, which is Ireland, where conquest is kind of, it's all about maintaining order.
There's a very, very famous woodcut of a cabin on the edge of a forest that's been burned down by a sort of band of raiders. And there's a woman outside holding her hands up in the air, kind of wailing as their house burns down. And there's a kind of doggerel verse underneath to say that this is how the Irish behave towards each other and so on, and that they basically need to be brought under the law.
Dr. David Edwards is a senior lecturer in history at University College Cork.
It's a very simplistic depiction of the Irish, but it's not entirely inaccurate. You know, there are 60 independent territories in Ireland in the 16th century, each of which has borders, and most of the time the borders are actually defined by conflict. So from that point of view, it's not wildly inaccurate. It's just that the supposition that this is the way the Irish always are towards each other, that's taking it a bit far. And then you move on and you have images of Sidney's forces at work. And there's one basically very famous sort of woodcut of them dealing with a sort of band of rebels, and they're chopping their heads off, and they're chopping the heads off the women as well as the men. And that does reflect much of what we know of the conduct of basically of the forces out there.
Can you tell me about Henry Sidney? Who was he?
Henry Sidney is one of the most prominent English officers in Ireland in the reign of Elizabeth I. He is Viceroy, or Lord Deputy, as they called it at the time. He was very conscious of his standing in posterity, and that he was creating something to be passed on to future generations. Be wary of people like that.
First appointed Lord Deputy from 1565, and again in 1575, Sidney was bent on securing the Midlands plantations of Leash and Offaly for the Queen, and extending English civility and reform.
And that's something that Sidney struggles with. All the governors struggle with that throughout the 16th century, because the natives don't just go away, they keep coming back. So the violence carries on.
I don't know if everybody notices, but when you look at the derrick, you'll see a bunch of heads on spikes. So the Irish traitors, as they would have called them, are displayed. And, you know, the warning is if you do go against Elizabethan control, this is what could happen to you.
Here, above the gates of Dublin Castle, over 440 years ago, hung the rotting heads of dead Gaelic lords and rebels. Recorded by the artist, this was a common intimidation tactic that increased under Sidney's command. Another was martial law.
England is very isolated as a Protestant kingdom, and with a Protestant regime that doesn't represent the majority of the population, which is just perfect fodder for international enemies of England to play. So Ireland is somewhere where the English feel particularly exposed. They don't have control over much of the country. They claim to have control over the country. And they claim after 1541 that Ireland is a kingdom linked to the kingdom of England. But it's a kingdom they have to make. And they have to negotiate, and negotiation takes time. A lot of that plays into an English impatience, an English willingness to just could basically, by any means necessary, take control now. And one of the things that grows out of all proportion is martial law. Now, martial law in England, it's an ancient method of repression. And in England, it's only used in times of rebellion against rebels while they are in rebellion. And as soon as they surrender, it's over. And that's the way it's supposed to work. The Tudors do grow martial law, nothing like in Ireland. In Ireland, martial law becomes normal. It spreads right across the country. And if you read the terms of these commissions, they are entitled to execute anyone on sight, without trial, on suspicion. On suspicion of crimes such as misdemeanours, wrongdoing. What the hell does that mean? Elastic powers, emergency powers, summary powers of death.
Sidney used martial law more than any other governor.
By 1575, Sidney is issuing martial law commissions to his military and privateer planters every 2 weeks, blanketing the country.
There is literally no year in the 16th century, it's from 1546, 1547, until 1603 when Elizabeth I dies. There is literally no year when there isn't a war going on somewhere between Crown forces and basically natives. There is a generalised policy of scorched earth employed from the start of the war. Any people found on the roads were to be killed on sight, including women and children. Wandering jesters, they're to be executed because they're deemed as being very suspicious, possible messengers. He sees the removal of the terrorising and if need be, the actual removal, the killing of large numbers of ordinary poor people in Ireland as a very necessary step. And yeah, he boasts about it. But then you do have as well, as I said, this cultural element and this religious sectarian element which creeps in. Elizabeth is not a religious fundamentalist. She's not a militant Protestant. But in Ireland, she's not here. Her people she trusts are not here. And there are many militant Protestants emerging in the captain's ranks and so on in Ireland from the 1570s onwards. And some of them, not all of them, some of them do accept the need for, from their point of view, severe measures. Just clean the landscape.
Derrick's image of Ireland precedes Edmund Spenser's anti-Irish view by over 15 years. Like Spenser, Derrick contends that civility is wasted on the Irish and portrays them in the worst terms possible. Depicted as violent, debauched, they were monsters of the world and beyond reform, spurred as they were to rebellion by Papist friars. Sidney is then portrayed as God's Protestant hand, ready to rid this beautiful land of such malignancy. In fact, in the imagined words of Gaelic Lord Rory Ogo-Moore, Sidney's most reviled Irish nemesis, Derrick's verse describes how the time draws near, in which the sept of my rebelling race shall be expired and abolished clean the land.
This is being placed right in the centre of an extremely expensive illustrated book glorying Sir Henry Sidney and the butchery of people. It's right there in the centre. It's not apologetic at all. This is what's necessary for civilization to prevail. That's the message it's actually trying to pass on. We tended not to look at the violence. It's an uncomfortable subject, but you cannot understand how Ireland is transformed by English intervention in the late 16th century without dealing with the violence. It's a violent change. An entire political order, an entire social order is knocked aside and subjugated. And then you have increased colonisation and so on, basically coming on foot of that.
Towards the end, he comes back into this courtyard, which we're now standing in. And in the background, you see a bunch of Elizabethan buildings, which are, of course, long gone. But here you see Sidney coming back, being met by the alderman and the mayor of the city of Dublin, his soldiers with their spears behind, the trumpeters are blasting. And the poem says, you know, the old great Sidney has come back and he has shown the Queen's face, so to speak, around the country.
So you talked about how these images were made by English artists. So what's at issue then when a country that's been colonised is visually represented by the coloniser?
Well, what we've got to do is make sure that we know that. And what I was saying earlier is, I mean, I'm an art historian, so I'm as interested in the way art history is told as much as... I mean, art history is not politically free.
So it's important to understand the context in which the work was made.
But the other side is, why was it painted?
If Image of Ireland was commissioned to preserve Henry Sidney's reputation, his actions ensured he lived long in folk memory. In October 1843, Daniel O'Connell held one of his last monster meetings at the Rath of Mulla Mast. It was a spectacular public gathering of support for his campaign to repeal the Act of Union, and as O'Connell told the gathered crowd, the location was intentional, as this was the precise spot of English treachery.
Over 260 years earlier, the leaders of seven Gaelic families of Laois were all murdered here, lured to their deaths under false pretense of negotiation, an action that many believed was sanctioned by Sidney. O'Connell's campaign for repeal would inflame negative portrayals of the Irish. For many, the phenomenal support he was mobilising represented a real threat to their continued prosperity and the unity of the empire. Where once the Irish were demeaned as lazy drunks and a source of Victorian entertainment, Ireland's politicians and her problems were now firmly and resentfully on the political agenda in London and in the British press. The anti-Irish bigotry in the artwork of satirical magazines of the time has been well documented. A Punch cartoon from July 1843 sees Daniel O'Connell portrayed as a fat ogre stirring a pot of agitation soup of the finest peasantry. Just as Derek had done, the Irish were again drawn as the savage enemy or the dim-witted pawn in a wider political plot. But these images reinforced an othering of Ireland's poorest especially that was now infiltrating every level of British society. And as emigration to England increased, racist depictions intensified.
The Punch images are about stereotyping the Irish and drawing attention to all of the negative or perceived negative characteristics.
Niamh O'Sullivan is Professor Emerita of Visual Culture at the National College of Art and Design and founding curator of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Quinnipiac University in the United States.
We're talking at a time when all the pseudosciences were in development. So there was the pseudoscience of phrenology, when it was believed that man's intelligence could be read from his human characteristics. So they were always taking out their calipers and measuring, you know, the depth of the forehead or the width of the jaw or whatever else. And from that, people were ascribing levels of intelligence. And there was an index of nigrescence. And the Irish were placed very low down on that evolutionary scale. And there were those that even argued that the Irish were the missing link.
What I've done is just taken out some of the things you mentioned, like Evans of Eton.
I'm in the prints and drawing room at the National Gallery of Ireland with curator Anne Hodge to talk about an artist whose discovery some years ago gave us a very important and rare visual record of Ireland's poor pre-famine.
They're incredibly rare. They're giving us a sense of what the Western Seaboard, Connemara, looked like. At this time, before the famine, 1838, it gives you a sense of how populated it was. These are by an English artist, William Evans, who was drawing master at Eton, and he's really interested in just describing the houses of the ordinary people and how they sat within the landscape, though very few artists actually made their way far west. But in this one here, you can see, the thatched house. You can even see the gharry, the raised garden to the left of the house where they would have grown vegetables and so on for the use in the house. As usual, you know, there were a few houses clustered together. And then you can see just people driving the sheep across. This is amazing to have these images of, you know, how people lived at the time. And you can see the thatch on this house is kind of falling down, it seems to be, you know, and yet people were absolutely living in these areas. Evans would have sold finished watercolours like this at the Old Watercolour Society exhibitions. They sold really well. The Bishop of Winchester bought one of his images. So people liked these images of, you know, native people and unexplored areas. It was a bit exotic. And it was helped along by all of this travel writing that was coming to the fore at this time. Henry Inglis doing his tour of Ireland in 1834, and then later writers in the halls and so on. So I suppose images like this went along with those travel books and that kind of writing.
So that narrative about Ireland and what you could find there if you went.
Absolutely. And depending on the writer, they would address the issues of the time. I mean, Inglis referred to the fact that his book was not entertaining because he was documenting a starving people. So even in the 1830s, there had been famines, repeated food shortages, although Evans gives us a slightly skewed image. It would have given a little bit of kudos, I suppose, to their publication to have someone of his calibre involved. Aside from that, they're very accurate, very beautiful. Many of the images are very romantic, and that would have helped balance, I suppose, some of the points they were making in their text as well.
Pre-famine, there was a shift in perspective. The Irish peasant was now seen by some as something of a cultural interest, and the Irish identity was reimagined.
The move for, if you want to call it, national school of painting began long before the Celtic revival.
Donal Maguire is curator of the recent Shaping Ireland exhibition at the National Gallery. We're standing in front of George Petrie's watercolour, The Stone Circle on Cann Hill, County Derry, that dates from 1840.
If you trace it back to the mid-19th century, when Thomas Davis wrote this famous essay on the state of Irish art and wanting to encourage Irish artists to explore Irish subject matter, and particularly Irish history subjects in painting, and to create a kind of a body of work that represented Irish history by Irish artists. And it wasn't a hugely popular trend that took off, but there was a movement within the art world and Irish antiquarians and Irish historians, a very small circle, but a very powerful movement within the Irish culture towards promoting an ancient Irish culture that was separate to British culture, with the purpose of showing that Ireland had this ancient, civilized, highly advanced race of people, that it wasn't, and to move away from the association of a kind of Ireland being a primitive race. George Petrie was probably the most well known. He travelled throughout Ireland, painting many of these ancient Irish examples of architecture and monuments. And much of his work was used in publication, tour guides at the time. But this picture we're standing in front of here is an image of a stone circle in County Derry. Much of the romantic representation of these sites that they were visiting, it meant that it was creating a more perhaps heroic vision of an ancient Irish culture as well. And that wasn't always necessarily transferred into the perception of the contemporary rural native Irish people, which were still often portrayed at that time in the 19th century in kind of cliched visions of people.
There was what is called in art historical terms a hierarchy of genres. And that meant that there was a kind of a pecking order of subject matter. And history painting was at the apex of that. And then below that, portraiture and landscape painting. Below that, again, genre painting, which is the painting of ordinary everyday people, and so on. So in the upper echelons of the hierarchy, landscape painting, they did have political intent, insofar as they reflected the land and the ownership of the land by landlords, but you don't see the peasant in them. And that's partly because it was the peasant didn't exist. They were there to just, you know, plough the land, look after the land and make money for the landlord. But they certainly weren't deemed worthy of being part of the subject matter until, in fact, by around 1848, when Edward Manet, the French artist, made the first call for an art of the people and by the people. And it was he who first started suggesting this should be the subject matter of art.
But then in Ireland came the spectre of something so awful, it changed everything.
The secretary might be in there.
I'm at the UCD School of Folklore with Catherine Marshall, an art historian and co-editor of Volume 5 of the landmark publication Irish Art and Architecture. We're looking for a painting of a moment that indelibly forged Ireland's identity.
It was moved recently, so it's in this.
It's dark in here.
It is weird, yeah.
We're looking at a painting called The Discovery of the Potato Blight, painted in 1847 by Daniel MacDonald. Daniel MacDonald was a Cork artist, quite a young man when he did this picture, early 20s. His family were really very, very caught up in the Cork intellectual environment, and there was a strong nationalist streak running through that group. So this is a fairly typical family. They've come to dig up their potatoes, and their faces tell us, you know, the potatoes are blighted. These potatoes here in the forefront are damaged potatoes. So the family is really devastated because they know now that they're in trouble. So the famine, just to go back on the history for a second, the first evidence of the blight appeared in 1845, and it meant that in 1846 people were hungry, but they were still optimistic and hopeful that by the following year things would have recovered a bit. But by 1847, not only did it not recover, but any stocks that had escaped the previous year are now all gone. So here is the family then. So there's a father and a mother that we see with her head buried in her skirts, utterly wiped out by the shock. Then there's an older daughter to the right of the father, and an older man behind him who might be the grandfather, clutching a small child. This family is now almost certainly utterly doomed. You know, there's no fallback for them except starvation or the workhouse, which might also mean starvation and almost certainly would mean disease.
The landscape here is ominous looking, isn't it? It's dark and craggy.
And that's something that Daniel MacDonald really goes in for, you know, landscape that is itself telling part of the story. And there really is very little hope here. And the weather also suggests just more cold and discomfort. If they're evicted now, they're going to be completely exposed to the landscape, which in this case is a very unproductive landscape. And even there's another creature in this, of course, which is a little terrier dog on the extreme right. And during the famine, the family dog took on a very sinister significance altogether, because the dogs roamed the country, gnawed at corpses on the road, and so it was.
There's real horrors hidden in this image.
Absolutely horrendous, yeah.
The poverty was unspeakable. The conditions in which people lived were unspeakable.
Niamh O'Sullivan again.
And during the famine period, as the evictions gained momentum, more and more people were put out onto the side of the road. They actually dug burrows in the ground, and they lived in what were called scalps and scalpines. And you have whole families burrowing down and living underground, and landlords trying to burn them out. I mean, there's a shocking story during the famine period when a landlord set fire to one of the burrows, and the charred remains of a child was taken out on a shovel. So this was not the stuff of art.
It's important to say this is 1847. MacDonald painted the picture. And as far as I can find, from having, you know, spent a lot of time going through the records for the whole 5 years when the famine was at its worst, this is the only painting that we know of that explicitly refers to the famine. Mm-hmm. Nobody else did it. So there's a huge question about why visual artists didn't reference this history.
1 million died. Horrendous, painful, terrible deaths. They died at the side of the road with their mouths green from trying to eat grass. They died, you know, babies trying to bite off the nipples of their mother to get a last drop of. How do you paint that? There is no way of doing it. The training of artists at the time is extremely important. They were trained to see the human figure in a very idealized way. So they started by drawing from casts, Greco-Roman casts. So by the time they got to painting a live person, their eye was so attuned to seeing the perfect form of the Greek male. So having been trained to see like that, even in illustration form, there are not many artists who draw on the emaciation of the human figure. You don't see, particularly Irish artists, going close up to show the pain or the misery.
Did it also, for the audience, you know, neutralise or make the images easier to look at?
It's a form of, you know, of dignifying the peasants in their terrible last days and not showing them, you know, up close, not showing their suffering.
As a genre, history painting remained the most likely to attract acclaim and launch careers in 1840s London. With their scale and subjects, these were the paintings of power. And yet, most Irish artists failed to present the history unfolding at home.
in general, they tended to avoid that kind of subject matter because we're talking about the time from the Act of Union in 1800 right through to the land wars. And politically, that was a very difficult time to be Irish in Britain and to be trying to make it as part of the establishment. After the Act of Union, any Irish artist with real ambition wanted to get to London as fast as possible, to, you know, the Metropolitan Centre, where there were patrons, where there were exhibition opportunities and so on. From 1779 to 1841, the population of Ireland went from about 4 million to over 8 million. Now, that's a staggering, over a 60-year period, that is a staggering increase in population. So the attendant social, economic and political problems were enormous. And these were not conditions that the British wanted forefronted through their cultural outlets in London. So Irish artists who went there weren't going to produce that kind of material, but it's very much in the background of what was happening. Certainly the famine itself was not portrayed by artists, with the exception of Daniel MacDonald. Mm. The discovery, an Irish family discovering the blight of their store, was thought to be the only painting that confronted the blight itself. But very recently, a companion painting of a famine burial was found, which is now very happily in the Crawford Art Gallery, which is really where it should be given MacDonald's background.
This is one of our most recent acquisitions that we bought in auction at the end of 2018, and we're really proud of it.
Mary McCarthy is director of Crawford Art Gallery. I want to look at this companion painting, The Village Funeral, and other works by MacDonald in the collection here to see how he portrayed this terrible reality.
We're looking at this very very poetic landscape of Ireland, folding kind of hills in landscape, and we're seeing these figures huddled around the earth, essentially, just hurtled around a recent burial scene. These people have been like ejected almost from the landscape, that there is nothing there for them. Even though in some ways, looking at it, it does appear quite lush.
Yeah.
So I think there's a bit of an irony going on there about potentially the kind of wealth of the landscape that is going elsewhere, and that the people who are populating the Irish landscape at that time are left to kind of be bereft in the landscape. So he's creating these scenes that are sad, that are tragic, that are routine, you could say, at that particular time in Ireland, but he's injecting something else in them which is a little unsettling.
It's interesting to think of.
Assistant Curator of Collections Michael Waldron brings me to see a later work.
This painting dates from about 1850 and is called Eviction Scene. It shows a rolling landscape, perhaps West Cork, and then in the foreground we have an old thatch cottage. And dominating the scene in quite a heroic pose, although looking dejected, is the tenant farmer. And you have on the right-hand side the bailiffs, perhaps the landowner or agent, and then on the immediate right you have this figure who's looking over his shoulder as he walks away from the gathered group, and he seems to be reaching into his, you know, inner pocket, as if maybe he has taken a bribe or that he is profiting somehow from this. So it really speaks to this sense of the tenant farmer being dispossessed of their livelihood, and that there are a number of people working within that system. Some are profiting, some are losing out. What we have here is one of the few examples of a fine artist responding very directly to what is going on in the Irish landscape in 1850.
But MacDonald was exhibiting these paintings in the salons of London. How was he doing that?
MacDonald grew up, I suppose, in the context of 1820s and 30s Ireland, and in the afterglow of the great collecting of Thomas Crofton Croker and Thomas More and so on, and this idea of an Irishness being built.
In 1845, when Daniel was 24, his father James discovered claim to the Annandale and Hartfell peerage in Scotland.
The family went to London to stake their claim to this peerage. They were well received in London, given this pedigree and this kind of background. So,
did they fit in quickly?
And they fit in extraordinarily quickly. So within months of arriving in London, the aristocracy, members of the royal family, were sitting for their portraits by Daniel MacDonald, while simultaneously he was painting paintings of eviction and poverty and famine and so on. Queen Victoria bought one of his sketches, and she ranked it very highly. It's kept in one of her most precious sketchbooks in the royal collections. So he was able, very unusually, he was able to straddle both strains of art in Ireland and in London.
Mm. Was he free to paint those kind of images of the famine because he was making a living from painting work that was commissioned?
Yes, and I think he made quite a lot of money. Mm. There was a lot of money involved in that.
If we think of the same time in France, you have the emergence of the realists. And their take on things, you don't get the same sense here. And it's slightly more romanticised in terms of its colouring and theatricality. So he's not cutting edge. He's not the avant-garde in that way. And yet, I think he's introducing something to an Irish and British household of some rank, a story that is acceptable, easily read, and helps you to maybe meditate on the subject.
That's what makes MacDonald exceptional. He used artistic conventions like classically posed figures or sublime scenes to present the most distressing, unwelcome subjects. Yet despite his connections and this careful construction, a story of famine would not be accepted.
The Irish peasant family discovering the blight of their store was exhibited in the British Institution in London to a resounding silence. There was almost nothing said about it. So obviously people were appalled by it. They didn't even want to comment on it. The subject matter was absolutely ghastly because it was poor peasants, but also indirectly reflected on the British handling of the famine in Ireland. So it was highly politically charged, and a veil was drawn over it.
In 1853, Dublin-born Robert George Kelly exhibited an ejectment in Ireland at the British Institution, previously seen in Dublin under its original title A Tear and a Prayer for Erin. It's a rare portrayal of a violent response to eviction and depicts a tenant farmer being arrested for the murder of a bailiff, with the tenant's family on their knees in anguish. Naively, perhaps, R.G. Kelly sought to make his name in London with this history painting. Although he never intended it as such, the work was resoundingly criticised for being political and even debated in the House of Commons. In fact, the critic in the London Illustrated News seemed outraged at what he deemed Kelly's vulgar attempt to manipulate sympathy.
That's right. That's right. And Kelly went off and painted very tame pictures from then on. He never tried that again because he had to survive. Mm. I mean, there are a few other paintings of evictions from Ireland in the last sort of second half of the 19th century. Very few, but a few. Some of them are painted by the Scottish artist Erskine Nicol, who came to Ireland and painted the Irish as fairly well-fed and well-dressed monkeys, you know, very simian and so on. Very charming pictures if you didn't identify with the person at the centre of them. So he's really saying, don't worry too much about the Irish. Don't worry about feeding them or clothing them or anything else. They're all right. Look at these guys are well fed, well nourished, well dressed, and they're not really human anyway. So Erskine Nicol wasn't that far away from, say, the Punch cartoons or something.
It was also pandering to either the stereotype of the Irish as being, you know, idle, neglectful of themselves, incapable of running their own affairs, all the things that justified the colonial machine in Ireland.
And paintings like these, some by artists who hadn't even been here, including The Irish Famine by George Watts, did little to dispel the hostile trope that the Irish were once again begging for a charity they didn't need or deserve. In terms of MacDonald's career and in terms of the types of images being made at this time, why is this painting so significant?
Because it is unique. There is no other painting. There is no other painting like it. There are other paintings, as I said, about poverty and about, you know, other aspects of it, of eviction and so on. But one actually showing this is the blight. This is what happened. And the whole story of 1 million deaths, 1 million immediate emigrations, followed by 2 further million emigrations to the end of the 19th century. So half the population of an entire country disappeared.
To
20 years later, in England in 1874, an unknown 26-year-old submitted a large oil painting to the Royal Academy, depicting exhausted soldiers lined up to answer a roll call after battle during the Crimea War. Duly accepted, it was a sensation. A policeman had to stand duty to keep the crowds behind the ropes when it was exhibited. The Queen wanted the painting for her personal collection, and it turned the artist into a national celebrity. I'm back at UCD School of Folklore with Catherine Marshall, where another of this artist's famous paintings resides.
We're seeing a barefoot woman in a red, you know, typically Irish dress for the peasants of the time, red flannel skirt and a shawl, and she's standing in front of the ruins of her house. The roof has been entirely stripped off it. You can see a tiny little glow of ember there that suggests that, you know, the fires that were used to burn her out are still not completely gone. And she's surrounded by the Wicklow Hills. This was set in Wicklow. You see the soldiers and the bailiffs retreating off into the distance down the valley. There's another cottage looking comfortable enough right now with a little puff of smoke coming from its chimney, but they're probably about to evict the people there as well. This painting is simply called The Eviction, and it was painted by a woman painter, Elizabeth Thompson, Lady Butler. And we might ask ourselves, why did she do it?
Up to this, Butler had predominantly painted scenes of British military campaigns and battles, a charging cavalry, regiments defending their positions.
Not only were they really good, you know, they really told the story that the Empire wanted to hear, you know, our gallant lads, you know, giving their lives, and some of them turn up for the roll call even though they do it with their last breath, you know. That really made Victorians feel very proud of the Empire, and she's always sort of lost in admiration for the achievements of the Empire. She doesn't really ever really ask herself, is this right, what we're doing to all those minions in other countries? But she did change that attitude in relation to Ireland. Mm. And I think that's probably because her husband was Irish, and she experienced Ireland in a different way.
Elizabeth Thompson had married Sir William Butler, a Tipperary-born officer of the British Army, and after a decade of overseas posts, the family came to stay at Monaghan in Delgany, County Wicklow, in 1888. Land agitation and independence had become one and the same conversation in Ireland by now, and William was especially impressed with the politics of their neighbour, Charles Stuart Parnell. He would write that Parnell did not tell the Irish that they were the finest peasantry, but that they had rights. A year later, Elizabeth would begin her most political painting. One afternoon in August, she received word that an eviction was taking place just a few miles away.
She writes about going from where she and her husband had been staying in Wicklow, near Delgany. She drove to see what was happening here. And she says that the woman was astonishingly sort of philosophical, stoic about what had happened to her, and that she had just come back to look for whatever she might salvage of her possessions. But what good are they to her?
So do you think that the impetus behind this image is what Lady Butler felt when she saw this woman standing in the landscape?
Yeah. And also I think you look at her expression. She's looking up towards the sky. She's not looking at the bailiff's men. She's not looking at her house. She's just really looking at fate and saying, what are you going to send me next? But she looks like somebody who is defiant in relation to that fate. And that's what Lady Butler admired about her. And Lady Butler also commented on the fact that the woman, you know, was, as I said, so philosophical and stoic, whereas Lady Butler herself was really indignant at the treatment that the English government was meting out in Ireland at the time.
So what happened then when she exhibited the eviction in the RA?
Well, once again, it was controversial. She put it in for the Academy and they accepted it. Now, they couldn't reject it because she's just much too important and famous now to be rejected. But there was considerable unhappiness about why a subject like that should be shown. And of course, one of the reasons for that is because the timing coincided precisely with the beginning of the land war in Ireland. And the Irish were really making a nuisance of themselves, taking up space in the House of Commons and so on. And yet, when It was shown at the Academy in London, and they had a special banquet to launch the Academy. Their guest of honour on that year was 1890, was Lord Salisbury, the Tory Prime Minister. And what did Lord Salisbury do? He needn't have commented at all about this painting. Lady Butler wasn't there to hear him one way or the other, because she was a woman and she wasn't allowed to attend the Academy as a woman. He needed to talk about it, though, because he wanted to refer to the situation in Ireland. And although it's a very sombre painting, he described it as a landscape, which it isn't. It's a subject picture, but he described it as a landscape painted with such breezy cheerfulness that he longed to take part in an eviction himself, either in an active or a passive sense. I mean, I'd say he was raging that this painting was put up at all, and they would have refused it had it been painted by anybody other than somebody with her very distinguished record.
Seems like his comments were trying to put her back in her box.
Oh, they were. And they were trying to put the whole, not just her, they were trying to put the whole business of an eviction in Ireland, which was a hot political issue, to downplay that. So nobody gets to criticise the empire.
I think one of the reviewers said that too evident a political bias was out of place in a work of art.
I think that's right. Well, in a way, the best thing to do with a remark like that is to laugh at it. But it's... You know, we've seen it ever since. I think what's really interesting is that they don't even see that all of the other work was very political as well, but because it was a politics that they agreed with.
So was being a history painter in this colonised landscape impossible then?
Yes, I do think that. The scale of Lady Butler's painting annoyed them. The scale of R.G. Kelly's painting annoyed them. But the fact that they were really associated strongly with Ireland in a personal way as well meant that they were seen as subversive. Because this is the 19th century. This is the age when social realism is very popular. Think of Dickens's novels. It's all right that, you know, in fact, not only is it all right to have hardship discussed, it's the flavour of the month, you know. But when the Irish did it, it got all this negativity. I think that's the basic factor. There are other factors as well, of course, which have to do with, yeah, I suppose they're all very closely related. Where do you show it? Who comes to it? Who talks about it? You know, because the visual arts until the late 20th century are very, very sadly very connected to wealth and social status. And that was not on the side of the poor.
But there was one artist whose politics was very much on the side of the poor and whose work was widely available in the heart of the empire during the peak of Fenian activity. In Dublin, Niamh O'Sullivan shows me some of her collection of artworks by Aloysius O'Kelly. The other particular image that we wanted to talk about is Arrested Under the Coercion Act, which you have a copy of here on the wall.
Oh, yes, it is, yes. This is a very powerful image. So it shows the arrival of the constabulary to halt the train which is travelling to the west of Ireland, and we have the arrest of the Landleaguers. So following on from this period, the Coercion Act was enacted, and it meant there were huge numbers of arrests made. You can see here there's huge clamouring and shouting. There are people who are, you know, shouting, leave them alone, and others who are trying to get them off the train to be arrested. So it's a very difficult image to portray, and it required huge skill to portray that number of people in that kind of compressed space. So Kelly was born in London into an Irish family, a very militant Irish political family. His own life and his work is sort of backlit by a very fiery, militant Irish nationalist and Parnell's closest confidant, James J. O'Kelly, his brother. Aloysius and James were very close. So James had moved back to Ireland. He obviously sent for Aloysius and said, come and let's kind of do this together. So he was projecting a very radical view of what was happening in Ireland. Things were deteriorating very badly in the late 1870s, and O'Kelly came back to document them.
In 1879, the Irish National Land League was founded in Mayo with Parnell as its president. And so began a campaign of rent strikes, boycotts and passive resistance to evictions that would become known as the Land Wars. Shortly afterwards, Aloysius O'Kelly was appointed as a special artist to the London Illustrated News.
He was entering a world that had provided one of the few visual ways for people to learn about the Irish famine and the awful conditions that had persisted for decades in the wake of starvation.
Now, why did this, was this allowed in this form? Well, watercolour and illustration were not part of the hierarchy of the genres that I mentioned earlier. But at the time, people did not much exhibit through watercolour. It was mainly oil painting. And certainly wood engraving was seen as journalism, not art. So artists felt able to experiment with concept and image in a way that they would not have felt through fine art, because these images were not destined for the venues or for the salon classes. So what you have then is a visual form of journalism. The truth breaks through sometimes, but not always.
The Illustrated London News didn't caricature Ireland or the Irish as Punch had done, but it did mirror British middle class attitudes and concerns, and at times leaned into the stereotype of the Irish. Coverage of Ireland was sometimes sympathetic and even liberal, but often conservative and alarmed at political agitation. So how was someone with O'Kelly's radical politics appointed as a special artist?
They all managed to play a double game. So there was James, the eldest, there was Charles, who was also an artist, there was Stephen, who was also an artist, and there was Aloysius. The stuff is really quite entertaining. So they were all had fake names, and there were always letters being passed in secret ink. It was all very carefully calibrated. So the family were very well connected in London. And so that's on the political side. But O'Kelly was one of the first artists to be accepted in the École des Beaux-Arts. So as an artist, he was seen as very up and coming as well. So the Illustrated London News would have been thrilled to get him. The Land League was formed in 1879, and he arrived back almost immediately, motivated by political as well as artistic interest. So the West of Ireland up to that period, insofar as it was very often portrayed by artists, was a much more romantic view than O'Kelly brought to it. Very interesting as well, you see women becoming more prominent. We have an image up here which shows the process server, which is the man who's coming to deliver the eviction notice. And then the women very often led the assault on him, and they would run him out of town. And you can see in this image here, you know, they had their rocks, and so they're attacking them. And then here we have the peasants actually arming themselves, I mean, admittedly with stones and sticks. But, you know, the huge bravery that's involved in that, because they're facing a barrage of guns.
Across the main body of illustrations directly attributed to Aloysius O'Kelly, there is no simonization of Irish people, no stereotype. Neither does O'Kelly aggrandise his subjects, but rather presents them as dignified human beings. And his skill as an artist, the immediacy and drama of his illustrations, meant that O'Kelly's image of Ireland and the Irish was circulated widely to a British and international public.
A single illustration could be reproduced 400,000 times. So it had huge possibility. Now, some of his illustrations were also pirated by some French journals like Le Monde Illustré, but O'Kelly would not have been against that at all. So some of these images appear in a lot of French illustrated newspapers at the time.
Did that shift the issue and the content and what he was talking about and the Irish story from being a domestic irritant to an international cause?
Exactly, yes. And I think both brothers were very influential in that regard, because the power of an image carries really much further than a written story. And these double page spreads that appeared in the Illustrated London News were intended to be taken out, and they were intended to be kept. And a lot of the French newspapers, they believed that the Irish were acting legitimately against people who had illegitimately occupied them.
And the newspaper as a medium, that's accessible to all types of audience.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So the general public had now a visual awareness of what was happening in Ireland.
Exactly.
Through O'Kelly's body of work, the audience could track the growing frustration and outrage of the crowd. Ireland's rural labourers were no longer jesters, or apes, or beggars, or thieves.
In O'Kelly's hands, the peasant becomes the agent of his own history. And they are very active people. So you see various images of, you know, an arrest at a railway station, or stopping a hunt to, you know, prevent the landlord classes enjoying themselves. So if you look at the one where they are throwing the rocks down on the constabulary as they arrive, so these are people who are taking control of their own destiny. And at a time when the concept of the nation was in formation, and he very much saw himself as visualizing a future nation rather than a subject people. O'Kellyn was trying to create a true identity visually so that people can see, you know, that this is a separate nation.
So the people are no longer props in the landscape?
Oh, absolutely not. They're dominant and they're strong. And they're taking control and they're on their way to achieving something.
Join me next time on Ireland Portrayed.
And actually, before we move on to that for a second, though, just back to Daniel MacDonald and the discovery of the potato blight for a minute. Do you know who owned that painting? The Gore Booth family, Countess Markovich, grew up with that painting in her home. So, you know, the pictures did obviously have some kind of an impact on shaping identity.